Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 27th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is John Marty. Today's session is entitled Tax Justice and the Gap Between Rich and Poor. Let's listen in.
It's good to see everybody has use for the pouncers they bring along here and often don't ever have a chance to use. This session is, the title of it was Tax Justice, How Tax Policy Affects the Growing Disparity Between Rich and Poor. And I'm John Marty, a back home in Minnesota, I'm a state senator, and tax policy at state and local, state and federal level has been changing significantly in recent years, and this does have an impact, a heavy impact, on the growing disparity between rich and poor. And I think I've found the last few sessions I've been talking too much and not enough questions, so I'll try and, discussion time, so I'll try and make the presentation time a little bit shorter. But what do I mean by the growing disparity between rich and poor? Certainly there are a growing number of billionaires in the country, and $1 billion for us as normal people is hard to fathom. They say you can count to a million in a couple of days. Well, billion, counting to a billion, since that's 1,000 million, if you can count to a million 24 hours a day in 2 or 3 days, you can count to a billion in 2 or 3,000 days. That's a lot of money, and there are a handful of people in a growing more than a handful of people who have become billionaires in recent years. But I'm not talking just about that. There's a very large and growing number of upper middle class folks who 30 years ago would have been considered wealthy beyond belief. The two-car garage expanded to the three-car, now the four-car garage. The big suburban home has grown to 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 square foot. Millions in investment, and you'd have to say in many ways money to burn. I always think it's kind of interesting if you look at the flight magazines on airplanes, they now have the catalogs in there too. It's kind of useless toys for, you never knew you needed until you saw them advertised and hyped, and all of a sudden you need them. The one that was, I saw about a year ago, I saw really bizarre in my mind was you could for $1,200 buy a little briefcase. You open it up, all it is a little model train, electric train, a very tiny one. It had scenery and everything else. And I was going to say, well, how often could you use this thing? You bring it on travel and show it to your grandkids when you're traveling or something. Very fascinating, but $1,200 is a lot of money for a little tiny toy train. And most people who are into model trains, a lot of them may end up spending more than that, but they tend to make it a major hobby and they build their own set and it takes up a room of the house and so on. But the point is there's a lot of people who have what we might call money to burn, and it becomes our growing need of necessities in effect comes as our desires change, as our income changes. And the point here is not to criticize them for having more than sufficiency. Though I think we ought to be concerned about overconsumption that we as Americans do in terms of the impact on the natural resources we have and on our environment, we can't really sustain life at the level of consumption we're doing right now, which I hope to get into a little bit more in, I think it's tomorrow's session on population. But this is not to criticize that they have more than enough, but it's to show that there is enough in society to meet basic needs. And this is the time when we have a growing number, and a rapidly growing number of people who are homeless. Pre-1980, I remember, I think there were 2 homeless shelters in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. They had a clientele that was very predominantly chronically mentally ill and chemically dependent, people who we've never done a good job of taking care of. They were street people and they needed a place to stay at night, especially in the winter time, and we had homeless shelters for them. Now, an old 100-year-old church in South Minneapolis that burned down a couple years ago rebuilt itself why did we need another church building in South Minneapolis where there are a lot more congregations? A lot of Lutheran churches have been sold to other groups because they didn't need them all. Why did they do this? Well, our Savior has a massive homeless shelter. Take care of many people, soup kitchens, homeless shelters. These are things we haven't had in the past. And if you look at the clientele of the homeless shelters, yes, there are some people who are chemically dependent. Yes, there are some people with mental health problems. The vast majority of people in these are now working people or families of working people, people who just can't, in the tight housing market, can't find enough money to pay the rent. And Barbara Ehrenreich wrote a new book, I think it's on the bestseller list last month, called Nickeled and Dimed. I think the title is something like On Getting By or Barely Getting By in America. And she's a writer who her editor suggested when she came up with the idea, saying some young writer ought to do this. He said, why don't you do it? And I don't know her age, but I got the sense it was not fresh out of college writer, but a 50-year-old woman or so. She went to four different communities around the country and worked her hardest to find entry-level jobs that could support her, just herself, not family or anything else, but just herself. And she tells the stories in there about what it's like. And there are many people, whether they're retail clerks or they're the people who clean the motel rooms we stay in, or a whole range of other things, people who aren't making ends meet. I met a waitress who couldn't afford the $75 to enroll her son in the summer soccer or softball league. Things that we might consider, well, that's not a necessity, but boy, if you have an 11-year-old kid who wants to and you can't take him on vacation, it is, in a sense, important. And how she sometimes didn't eat enough at the end before the next paycheck came in. She didn't eat anywhere near her fill, drink water, do whatever, do without, so her son had enough food. Can talk about the widow who I met campaigning a couple years ago, who was afraid she was going to lose her house for 40 years. She couldn't afford the increasing property taxes. What's she going to do with her dog, her only companion in any apartments near where she lived? She had no real transportation other than public transportation or walking. No apartments nearby that she knew of would take her dog. These are situations that's not, she's not a woman who's likely to starve because of this, but losing your house, not knowing where you're going to go. I don't think those are even situations we should find. And again, the number of working people who can't afford basic medical bills, housing costs, basic needs. Should this be something we care about? I would suggest, as Christians, yes. I mean, I think Christ and certainly the Old Testament prophets talk heavily about the importance of caring for those in need, for taking care of our brothers and sisters who are lacking. But here, let's talk about it as a society. Should we as a society be concerned about this? Should we be trying to do something about this? Last week I talked about what I see as a compact that our government made with the American people 70 years ago in the New Deal. One of the biggest tenets of that compact was you work, we're all supposed to contribute to society, and paid employment is a major part of how we do that. What is full-time work? Well, it was at the beginning of the New Deal, 44 hours, which was down significantly from the 6, 10, or 12-hour days that the Industrial Revolution brought in. 44 hours a week, later changed to 40 hours a week. That was full-time work. You work full-time. You're not going to get rich, but we're going to provide you at least a minimum wage, which should be sufficient to cover basic necessities. We are going to help make sure you can get affordable health care, housing, food, basic necessities. And governments sort of said, you know, we will help take responsibility that if you're injured, your employer injured on the job, your employer will help take care of it. If you're injured some other place, you become disabled, you can't work, government will step in. That was part of the social compact, the social contract we had under Social Security. We're going to help you until you get your feet back on the ground, and then you work and you support yourself. If people aren't making enough if we have working people who are living in homeless shelters. There are alternatives on how we can address this. We can address this by, as we've done many times over the years, providing government subsidies for housing, for childcare, for food stamps. Or we can make sure that the money they earn is sufficient to do that. And you can do that through higher wages, a living wage concept, which I did a session on last week. And also, the tax system relates to this. The tax system has a big impact on it. However, recent state and federal tax changes have not moved that way. Tax jargon in politics is a progressive tax is one that the more you make, the more you pay. The income tax is one of very few progressive taxes we have. It's not a flat tax. You earn below a certain amount in Minnesota, you don't pay any income tax on it. Above a certain amount, you pay 6%, well, 5.5%. Above that, you pay 7.5%, and the top rate of about 8-something percent now. That's a progressive tax. You earn more, you not only pay more, but you pay at a higher rate. Most other taxes work out to be opposite. Certainly, like Social Security, Medicare payments, you pay a flat tax until it's capped at a certain level. I don't know what the cap is now, $75,000 or so. Beyond that, you pay no more into it. So in effect, it becomes a flat tax. It becomes regressive at higher incomes. And so people who are making $30,000 a year pay a higher percentage of their income in Social Security and Medicare taxes than somebody who's making $100,000. That becomes a regressive tax. Property taxes, they may have other unfairnesses, but just talking in the who pays the burden in terms of wealth, in terms of income level, property taxes, sales taxes, excise taxes like on alcohol, tobacco, other things where there's a flat tax, not based on the price. Some gas taxes are sales taxes in some states, others are excise taxes, which is based on the quantity. As I mentioned, Social Security and Medicare payroll taxes are regressive. Perhaps the only taxes I think of that anybody uses to raise any significant amount of money that aren't regressive, that are progressive, even if slightly, would be the income tax and the estate tax. And when we calculate what taxes are progressive and regressive and how much somebody's paying in tax burden, we find out that the federal taxes are somewhat progressive. State and local taxes, almost without exception, total up to be regressive. Namely, the poor pay not more total dollars, but they pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes. In Minnesota, some of those who argue against progressive taxes towards a more flat tax concept, they say Minnesota's already got one of the most progressive state and local tax systems in the country. We're slightly regressive, but it's more progressive than everyone else. Income tax, a lot of states don't have an income tax. I don't think South Dakota, I don't think Washington State does. New Hampshire, lots of other states don't. Many of the southern states don't. And if that's the only tax that's based on ability to pay, you're going to have a very regressive tax system. The woman I mentioned earlier who I had met who was afraid of losing her house because of rising property taxes 200 years ago probably was a progressive tax. If you were a farmer and you had more land than some other farmer who had less land, you had more ability to pay, so you paid more in property taxes. Nowadays our tax system is such that a lot of the percentage of money you have invested in property may have very little to do with your income. And renters in Minnesota pay a higher rate through their rental payments than homeowners do, significantly higher rate, double the rate. Are renters more able to pay? No, not really. It would tend to be the opposite. But even when you calculate this, and again, as I said, Minnesota's total state and local tax system is slightly regressive and becoming more regressive in recent years, none of this factors in other things. If I am a blue-collar worker, do I get a lunch break? It may be unpaid, I may get a lunch break, but I bring my lunch in, I pay for it, or if I go out to eat for lunch at McDonald's, I'm paying taxes on that. if I'm top executive in the business, lunches are often a fringe benefit. There are fringe benefits like that, and the biggest one is probably health insurance. The blue-collar worker or the retail clerk or somebody else may not have their health care benefits. If you buy health insurance under federal law and under most state laws, you don't get to deduct that premium cost, whereas I and anybody who has it as a benefit will work, which maybe half the country does have. Those of us who are fortunate enough to have it through work, that comes off our paycheck pre-taxes. It's not taxed. Again, so the tax system is actually much more regressive than you'd think just by looking at the pure burden of taxes based on income. Well, even little things, frequent flyer miles. The executive who does a lot of travel, gets frequent flyers, that's not a taxable thing. Yet their vacations are partly paid for because of their work. That's a benefit that's not taxed. Somebody else who's going is paying the taxes. So the tax system tends to be, in almost every state, in some very much so, where lower income people pay less. In Minnesota, the top 1% pays an average of about 9%, 9.5% to 10% of their total income in state and local taxes. The average middle class person, let's say by middle class, $30,000 to $80,000, that the average middle class person is going to be paying more like 11 or 12%. Can they handle that? Probably. But then you get to the bottom end, and it stays around 10, 11, 12% for most, and then you get the very bottom end, it goes up to more like 20%. That's when you factor in, and these tax studies factor in what percentage of a business tax is paid by who. Because a business doesn't eat the tax itself, it passes it on in their consumer products. So anyhow, the bottom end of people, at least in state and local taxes, are paying very high percentage of their income in that, and you'll get the spikes, and of course not everybody with the identical income is paying the same level in taxes. Some taxes have less horizontal equity than others. Property taxes, at least in Minnesota, you have two identical homes that are across the street from each other in different communities, different school districts, different counties. You may have identical valued homes, one paying 30% more than the other. Roughly the same services, but you look at the tax base in the community. Or the identical valued house in different communities where the identical sized house, but different tax assessments in different communities, you have inequities there. And you often get the senior citizen who's lived in the house for 30, 40 years, it's their house, and they have property taxes go up. Income stays the same because their retirement income. And same thing, you get laid off from your job, all of a sudden your ability to pay goes down, but your property taxes, other things stay the same. If we have this system now, have we decided in recent years to make it more progressive in a way that, in effect, a regressive tax system would increase this disparity between the wage gap between those with more and those with less? It increases the disparity. Are we trying to change this? Well, certainly you look at the federal tax cuts in recent years, they've been much disproportionately more on things like estate taxes, which again under current law, it was going up to $1 million was exempt. So if you're passing on $1 million to your kids right now, I think it's like 600, 700,000, you're passing that on to your kids. A couple can pass on twice that amount, 1.2, soon up to $2 million in taxes, totally tax-free. And those are the taxes we're proposing at the federal level to eliminate. In Minnesota a couple years ago, I was the only no vote on a tax bill that was billed the largest tax cut in state history. You can tell from that, in the House it was a little different, but in the Senate, nobody from either party dared vote against it because it was the biggest tax cut in history. But look at where it went. 85% of the public got less than the top 15% combined. If you factor it, well, they say, well, they pay more in taxes. Yeah, but they don't pay that much more in taxes top 15% did not pay more than half of the total state and local tax burden, but they were getting more than half of the tax cuts, more than their proportional share, even if you were having a flat tax system. But they were getting the biggest share of that, and maybe this is what the public wants. I would argue every poll I've ever seen suggests that, first of all, most of the American public, probably 80%, would believe we ought to have that social compact that we set up in the New Deal long before I was born. That this compact where you work full time and you should be able to pay the basic bills, 80% of the public will say they support that sort of thing. How about the tax code being a part of it, though? Well, I don't know. I haven't seen polls saying, let's do this and let's do this. But when the tax cuts came, the one in 1999, where over half the benefits went to the top 15%, all three parties, our governors and independents party person, Democrats and Republicans, all of them went all over the state bragging about this wonderful tax bill. And the common line used by all three parties was this bill was, quote, heavily tilted in favor of the middle class. Well, when the top 15% are getting it, more than half of everyone else, I don't know how you define middle class. That might be it. If you say 99% of the public is middle class, then maybe they get most of the tax cuts. But the middle 50% in Minnesota, drop off the poorest 25%, the wealthiest 25%, the middle half got well less than a third of the tax cuts. And so even while we're making the tax cuts come out heavily tilted towards the high end of incomes, making it more regressive, the people passing the legislation are bragging about how they did all this for the middle class, and they made sure the bulk of the benefits went to the middle class. I'd argue if you want to do that, at least you should be as truthful about what you're doing. And I don't think they were trying to lie, I just think they didn't. They were doing this and they wanted to make it sound good. Some of them may have thought it was tilted towards the middle class, though the numbers didn't show that. Why are we moving this way where the tax system is becoming more regressive, which some people favor? And I would not be surprised. I mean, in Minnesota, we have a group, it's 102 or 103 of the largest firms, the CEOs, have what they call the business partnership. And they tend to lobby heavily for cuts in income tax. And when we have to raise taxes, they're like our governor, they think we should be moving to the sales tax, which is the most regressive major tax we have in Minnesota. They tend to favor that, and you can understand why from their own point of view. That's where they pay their taxes in. The property taxes are basically insignificant to them, sales tax and income tax, a much lower percentage of their income. Others pay much more than them in that, and the income tax is the one that hits them hardest. It's not universal. It's not everyone with a lot of money thinks it should be that way. I think George Soros, the billionaire, Bill Gates Sr., they were in Washington testifying against, or I don't know if they went to Washington, but they've spoken out repeatedly against efforts to repeal the estate tax. They said, you know, in our country, we have not had this aristocracy where you pass on wealth from generation to generation. Sure, you can pass on some of the family farm or business or something else, and sure, you know, they felt we sort of had a balanced system that way, but they argued in favor of people working to get ahead, not inheriting to get ahead. And so people with wealth are not always saying that they favor it. I know a number of Minnesota very wealthy individuals, business partnership members even, who would say, yeah, we should have a balanced tax plan that in their eyes would mean that they are fortunate enough to be well off, they ought to pay more. I like a quote from one of Minnesota's heroes, Kirby Puckett. One year when he was playing great baseball and making lots of money, somebody told him, was complaining about the tax system, and told him, you realize you're paying this much money in taxes on that kind of income? And he said, I'm paying that much in taxes? I must be doing pretty good. And I thought that's one of the reasons I think people like Kirby Puckett. I mean, he's the kind of guy who who's not grumbling about it, he's saying, you know, I'm doing well. I think this is a fairness issue. Again, if we don't do this, if we want to live up to this compact where you work, somebody who's a hard-working person should be able to make their ends meet. We have two choices if we're going to take care of that. One is to subsidize it, or two is to make sure they can have the money. And there are some provisions in our tax code in recent years that have helped, but overall, we're trying to move, we seem to be moving away from that. And I'm one who thinks we should have a progressive tax system, though I also think it's not unwise to use certain taxes which tend to be regressive to discourage behavior or encourage behavior. Taxes that encourage, tax incentives that encourage renewable energy or energy conservation, that's not a dumb thing to do. Taxes on fuels and so on may not only be a user fee that pays for roads and so on, but may discourage the bigger, more energy consuming vehicles. There are reasons we do that. Taxing cigarettes higher to help pay for some of the healthcare costs they generate is not a dumb thing to do, but you got to recognize that these taxes tend to be regressive and, if anything, add to that. So if we're going to do that, we ought to make sure the tax system is at least balanced out by some taxes that are progressive. Anyhow, I've gone on for close to half an hour, and I think that this is the type of topic, I don't know which way it goes in the discussion, but I'd like to open it up, and who would like to start out? Questions, if not, go ahead.
The estate tax. You were talking about the baseball player that was talking about, well, gee, that's fair. How fair is it to have a person pay taxes on his income for his entire life, and then when he dies, for the government to turn around and come in and tax it all over again? I mean,
okay. Double taxing kind of issue. You're saying we're double taxing that. Is that the gist of the question?
Is it fair?
The way we often hear, every time somebody wants some change in something, we're double taxing this and so on. The bottom line, the way I'd like to suggest we look at it is, government is going to determine how much money it needs to operate. And some people say it should be more, some should say it be less. But once it does, it's going to collect a certain amount of money. If we had simply taxed, if we took it all, say, with an income tax, a progressive income tax, at one time, I don't know what it was, I think it was at one time, federal income tax hit a nominal, at least, there were a lot of exemptions, but nominally hit 70%, I think, at one point. It was 50% 20-some years ago. It's dropped significantly since then. Is it less fair to somebody that we tax them at a 50 or 60% when they first get it and don't have an estate tax, or that we tax them at 40% when they're earning it and then we tax the estate? In the bottom line is, it depends how you want to categorize it. Is our tax system fair? I was going to say we get 40 people in the room will probably have 40 different concepts of what's a fair tax system. But in terms of whether it's fair, whether something is a double tax or not, in that sense, hey, you're paying tax on the income as it comes in, you're paying a sales tax on the way it goes out. Is that a double tax too? I was going to say that most of the time when we talk about double taxing of something, it depends on how we do it. I think the arguments that I'm not in the shape of one who's going to have a big risk of having a large inheritance to be taxed, but George Soros and, well, Bill Gates' son doesn't need an inheritance, but George Soros and others who are in that shape where they have hundreds of millions at minimum to give away to their kids, their arguments are, and they're very persuasive about it, that they think it's that's their money, and I think we as Christians don't see this as, in that sense, it's not our money. I think what I own right now, we get into this discussion of property rights and so on, and we very much in society now talk about, this is my property, I earned it fair and square, and or some would argue much of the land in this country we stole it fair and square. But it's now ours. However I got it, it's mine and I deserve to do it. And I can do whatever I want with the land. It's mine, it's my right. If you come back to the same room, if the same room is here 200 years from now, I'm not going to be here. And if you come to my house in Roseville, Minnesota, a decent house, I'm happy with it, nice yard. If I do things there that destroy the land or do things that are unfair to it, do I have rights to that? I was going to say, as Christians, we should be seeing this is all gifts from God that we have a right to for a certain number of years, but is it mine for the rest of eternity and me and my heirs and so on, or is it something that we all have an obligation to future society? In Minnesota, we have a common law against perpetuities where I can, in perpetuity, determine that certain things are going to happen with certain possessions and so on. There are limits to how you can will certain things that you can't demand that nobody can ever do certain things with a piece of property because of that. I guess that's a philosophical discussion. Do you think somebody, when we leave, we don't bring anything with us? And because my kids are so-and-so, get so-and-so much from their parents, and some other kids get nothing from their parents, and other kids can get billions from their parents. Is that fair? Well, I'd say George Soros, who's got more of it than all of us combined will ever have, was arguing it is fair to take some of that away. And you're arguing, well, it's been taxed once. So I was going to say, when we talk about double taxing, I've heard double taxing used on almost anything, and basically it's an argument for a certain thing, but you could take away more of it with a progressive income tax and never have to worry about estate tax. Some would argue that way, but but once government sets a level of spending that it's going to use, that's going to come either from the estate tax or it's going to come from something else. And the way it's been coming in recent years, it tends to come from the regressive taxes that hit those who can't afford their own housing.
Well, the flip side of the way of looking at that is that you're not being double taxed because you're not being taxed. You're dead. You're gone. It's your heirs that are being taxed, if you want to look at it that way. But they aren't even being taxed. They're still being given a gift, basically, that they didn't do anything to earn, or maybe they did nominally. Maybe they helped out on the farm or something like that. But
It all depends on how you think about it. Yeah. Is it your money? Is it your family's money? Or is it the government's money?
Or is it society's money to use for health care and nursing homes and all kinds of services that we as a community need?
You're talking about the billionaires. They have so much money that it makes no difference to them whatsoever. Let's face it, when you have billions of dollars, you might as well be a socialist and believe that everybody should just have everything they want as long as
some billionaires may be that. Some billionaires are also the ones who are asking for subsidies from government, which in Minnesota, I know of at least 4 billionaires, and we can't have more than 7 or 8 who are asking for publicly funded subsidies for things.
Well, they...
And so I was going to say some...
No.
I was going to say both. I agree. But most... I'm saying that when you're saying billionaires, they got so much money it doesn't matter to them. Well, often the more money somebody has, you look at charitable giving and how much people give to churches, the largest charitable recipient of dollars in this country. But you look to charitable giving, and there are a few exceptions, but I was going to see whether you look at Al Gore or George W. Bush or Joseph Lieberman or Dick Cheney, and none of them are poor. Some of them are... What was it, Cheney, $36 million in income last year? Not $36 million wealth, but that's a lot of money. And you look at least at the federal candidates, you see their tax returns and how much they're giving to charities. Gore didn't give much of anything. I don't think Bush's gave a lot either. And you tend to look, it tends to be maybe it's the widow's mite parable. I mean, sometimes the people who are struggling to get by tend to be more generous. I don't think you can make these as rules across the board, though, because there's some very generous billionaires, there's some very generous low-income people, and there's some very, very tight-fisted, perhaps is the word, billionaires and lower-income people. But saying that billionaires can afford to be that way, I was going to say, lots of people would say the multimillionaires who have estates to worry about can afford to, too. It all depends how you look at it, and lots of them are in different shapes. I don't think we can uniformly say this is the way rich people or poor people think.
But what about a middle-income guy with a business, a family business, a family farm? I don't know how it works. Maybe right. Farms are different. It gets turned over to the son and taxed at 40%. He can no longer afford to operate it. He's lost it. He's going to have to sell it or break it up because he can't. At 40%, there isn't the cash there to pay it, or a business the same way. How often does that happen that a business has to be broken up to pay the estate tax?
Okay, I was going to say that that's kind of the argument that's been made on why estate taxes have been the exemption from estate taxes going up to, I think under current law, prior to anything done this year on estate taxes, it was going up to $1 million a person to help keep those together.
Okay.
If I have a privately held company worth hundreds of millions of dollars, saying, well, I can't turn it over to my son, he's going to have to pay 40% tax, he can't handle that. What works in any other business is you own shares of the company. You sell shares of the company, you don't have to break up the business. And multi-million dollar farms, people do split it up among kids. People share, pay this, and frankly, most business owners have borrowed a lot of money in their lives in terms of building up their businesses. In effect, if I, as the recipient of somebody's inheritance, have to pay some steep taxes on it and borrow money to do it, I'm still significantly better off doing it. That's the argument they make, that you're going to have to break up the business, but my father-in-law's business, nobody could afford to buy it and whatever else, and hey, estate taxes might force it to be broken. No, estate taxes would force you to sell shares in the business. But that's the whole argument. Are you destroying the business in order to do that? Most major businesses in this country are publicly held, and most estates are not exclusively my business. Most very successful people divest their money into a whole lot of different investments, and if you have to sell some stocks to pay for ownership of others, that's the way in reality it works in most cases.
When you talked about what was going on in Minnesota with this big tax cut that only benefited the 15% of people becoming more regressive, and the same thing happening in the federal tax cuts. Where is the will coming? It seems to me that they do have a lot of popular support, yet they don't necessarily benefit a great many people, and that really puzzles me.
Why is there public willingness to do this?
Yeah. Well,
there are several. I know some of the people in the room are Minnesotans, and I'd be curious if a single one of the Minnesotans in the room had any clue that the vast majority of our tax cuts in the last couple of years have gone to the high end. And that's not saying nobody else received anything. Matter of fact, the temporary one-time tax rebates that we've had three years running, those tax rebates have been much less regressive. Matter of fact, they may be slightly progressive because they've been based on sales tax, which is a regressive tax. They've been capped at the top end and a minimum at the bottom end for people who are paying this. It's roughly based on your income. So I'd argue that it's a fairly progressive tax cut. And how many people heard that the ongoing taxes, the taxes that took effect 2 years from now that are still happening, which is a lot more money than the rebates, how many have heard that those are heavily tilted towards those with higher incomes? I'd say almost nobody has, because all three parties were talking about how this was tilted for the middle class. That's what they heard. The middle class got the bulk of the advantage. Maybe they got the sense maybe the poor weren't getting much, but they certainly didn't get the sense that they were getting less than a proportional share, not more than a proportional share. So it's the way it's sold. I mean, there's no real discussion. The average citizen doesn't have time to calculate, well, here's how much people in my income are paying on this kind of taxes. The newspapers in their detailed analysis have little bits and pieces of facts, but not a lot.
I think on the federal level, with now everybody getting this $600 check or whatever it is, I kind of feel like it's buying everybody off. And, wow, this can't be bad. I got $600, you know. And
no, you haven't.
Yeah.
No, you haven't. I'll bet you $10 you won't.
I hear your point on that. And it's interesting because in 1999, this other tax bill, I would care to guess most Minnesotans wouldn't know this either, but the state actually borrowed more money to increase the size of the rebate. We borrowed $400 million to increase the size of the rebate. Who pays that $400 million of principal and interest? It's the same, yeah, with the interest. You got to pay eventually because it's, but bottom line was we took some projects we had borrowed money, we had paid cash for, some capital investments, and they said, well, normally capital investments, like higher education institution buildings or things like that, we usually pay for those things over long term, so even though we put cash into that, we're going to take the cash back, borrow money, and that gives us $400 million freed up to increase the size of the rebate. I'd argue that makes politicians look very good in an election year. Our governor calls them Jesse's rebate checks. I mean, boy, it makes everybody feel good. They're getting a rebate now. Praise the people then. Who pays for it? Well, it's the same people. It's the same 4 or 5 million people in Minnesota who are going to pay those costs eventually. Yes, that's what the public seems to see. They see the rebates. They don't question. You know, the federal government still has a massive debt, and we are paying principal and interest on it and giving rebates now. You might argue that's a good thing to do to stimulate the economy, but it's also a thing that you are ultimately going to pay those bills.
Maybe you can explain something to me, which has always puzzled me. You get an economist on, you know, NPR at 8 o'clock saying, oh, the savings rate in the United States is less than it is anywhere in the country, and people are only saving, and the debt, credit card debt is incredible, blah, 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 blah. And then 2 hours later, you get another economist saying, oh, my God, we're going to go into a recession if people don't spend. Appliances and the car market is down and the housing market is down. And we've got to encourage people to go out and spend. Now, maybe I'm stupid and I accept that, but can you, I mean, what is the deal here? I mean, am I supposed to save money or am I supposed to buy a new car?
That's entirely in soul.
That's right. And God forbid that we should save our tax rebate. No, we're supposed to take the tax rebate and go out and buy yet a bigger house and a bigger car. So,
Yeah, you get 100 economists in the room, you'll get 100 opinions. And but no, there's obviously the way we measure economics in the country and in the world these days, consumer spending is a sign of a healthy economy, so the more you spend, the better. I think a lot of us feel is that consumerism is not necessarily a healthy thing, and it's what we're doing now is not sustainable. I don't think we can say that if we keep consuming our resources at the rate we are, sure, we got 300 years plus of coal. If we're going to consume coal to do things, by that we would destroy the environment. We are running out of a lot of resources, not short term. I mean, maybe landfill space in the Twin Cities area of Minneapolis-St. Paul will run out of space in in 10 years and we don't have a clue where we're going to site new landfills, and already a lot of our trash goes to Wisconsin. I'm sure they want it. In Iowa. But we can't deal with certain waste we've generated for nuclear waste. We don't have any intention of dealing with it. We people in eastern Washington and down the Columbia River from there, that's their problem, or their grandchildren's problem. But I was going to say, I'm not a big fan of saying, let's go out and consume more in order to boost the economy. I think we have to figure other ways. There are ways you spend money as a society that does stimulate the economy that's not wasteful. I was going to say, a lot of those tend to be human goods and services. Education, quality of care in nursing homes. Those are spending just as much, the same way when we measure the gross domestic product level, how well the economy is doing. You know, if we all get in auto crashes, it's going to really boost the economy because you spend a lot more money to repair cars or buy new cars and insurance, everything else. There's a lot of money changing hands, so it's a growth in the economy, but is all growth in the economy healthy? Some of it, we'd argue, is negative. But so if you're trying to do it, there are ways to stimulate the economy that are not through consumer goods purchases. But I was going to say that, yes, the economists, those two things may sound inconsistent, but we do have record level of consumer debt. And it's often the people who can afford it least, and in effect, I don't know, I see credit cards with 18-19% interest on. And people, hey, I use my credit card to make money. I get 1% cash back on it, and I pay my bills on time, so I don't have any of that. But I know a whole lot of people who are deep in debt on credit cards, and some of them, they're in a cycle that's going downward, and with bankruptcy laws tightened, in effect, we're going to imprison them in debt somehow or another. But the economy does get stimulated. You give people money in a tax rebate, and they will spend a good portion of it, and so it does stimulate the economy. But we do have a problem with that. They're two separate things, and they're both true. Oops, I'm sorry, they're after this one. Go ahead.
This is a little similar to that gentleman's question, but let me ask, you made a pretty good point for saying why Minnesotans may not have realized that the tax cut was mainly going to the wealthy. But it seems like in the last, in the presidential election, that Gore said so many times that this tax cut that Bush was proposing was going to the wealthiest. And so let's say that, you know, people were informed that that tax cut was mainly going to the wealthy. Where is the support coming from for that if we're all informed? Is it that the lobby from the wealthy people is that strong and that they hold back their money for other things if they don't get it? Or I couldn't believe okay. that they would get it. You know, I mean, I just figured that they end up paying more taxes and not getting the cut, but they got it.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that talk, once you throw politics into discussion of tax policy, it tends to be who's going to raise your taxes. The other side's always the one that's going to raise your taxes. We're going to lower your taxes. And then you get into, no, they're going to lower taxes for this group and not for you. It gets very political and very noisy, and who do you believe? And the debate in recent years has been, I actually suggested here, I'm talking about the idea of progressive taxes. I have a bill I've introduced that would increase the excise tax on alcohol by a nickel a drink to pay for chemical dependency costs. It's a regressive tax, but I'd argue that that's one that for social purposes of making sure the people who consume and the people who profit from the sale of alcoholic beverages should pay the cleanup costs to society of that. So you're proposing, why didn't that go? I think I've got two polls in the last 6 years in Minnesota where 80% in one and I think 83% in the other, 84% in the other one, support an increase in alcohol taxes in order to fund efforts to prevent DWI and other crimes related to these things. If the money's channeled that way, 80 to 84% are willing to support that. Why did the bill got modified suddenly in one committee and never got a hearing in the next? Why won't it pass? Because it's increasing taxes. Despite 75% or more willingness to do that in most states, I think California, there was a voter initiative to do that 10, 12 years ago, a penny a drink to fund things like this, and Anheuser-Busch spent $17 million talking about them trying to raise your taxes. That opinion changes with heavy marketing and sales on why this is a good thing. And in Minnesota, our business partnership funds all kinds of efforts, study groups, think tanks, and others who have opinion leaders, who, and the CEOs themselves are opinion leaders in the media. And they turn to them often on what's a good tax policy. And so I think I would care to bet if you talk to the editorial writers in both of the two biggest papers in Minnesota that they would have no concept of even within guess of what percentage of the tax cuts we gave in recent years went to the high income and what went to middle and what went to low income. They wouldn't have a clue of that. And they're the informed ones who study the issues and who listen to all the experts. You go to the Department of Revenue, I can show you the numbers on who gets the benefits. And, oh, yeah, maybe you said, well, I didn't think about that. Or nobody showed, why didn't anybody tell us about it? Well, the people who have the money to lobby on the tax policy, or the ones who do, are not the ones who are looking for a progressive tax policy. That was a long answer. I don't mean to go on that long with these.
The estate tax, I know an estate planner, and he was at a session where the guy that crafted this new estate tax system stood up and started his session by saying he was chartered with coming up with a way to modify the system so that it looks good to the American people, but at worst does not decrease inflow to the government, and ideally will actually increase flow of money into the government. And then he went on, he said, and then he gleefully said, and let me show you how I did it. So ultimately, we will pay and pay and pay.
And again, today's talk isn't on terms of how much money government could or should spend or something. But I mean, that's an issue. I mean, I'd argue government should not be involved in certain things and it should be heavily involved in other things. Having said that, once those decisions are made, the money to fund all those things do come in from taxes. 100% of the money government gets is from taxes. And as we hear when we're just when people saying, I want my rebate and I want it now, it's my money, you overtax me, it's my money. I was gonna say that's true. Every penny, not just what they're calling overtaxation, but any money government gets is their money. And they're also their schools and their roads and their environment and everything else. And we as a society can choose to do that. We can say everybody, it's survival of the fittest, you take what you can get. We don't need people to regulate against antitrust and everything like that. If you can build up a monopoly and rob everybody blind, it's yours. And you need police force to protect your wealth, you get your own private security firm. And we could move to a dog-eat-dog world. I think most people believe in a common good as well as individual good, in a common public education system, decent roads and infrastructure, and that we as a society actually do better when we do those things. Not everybody agrees with that, but once you determine the level of government spending, then how do you get the money? Is it a system? And again, I would, in my description of a fair tax, would say it would be a progressive tax system that doesn't aggravate our disparity between rich and poor, but one that would reduce it.
I'm sure we've all played the game of Monopoly as children and believed that it was just a game played with paper money. I've always remembered the feeling of, you know, that game, if you play it to the end, one person ends up with it all and everybody else is crushed economically. There are many people in this country and in this world that believe that that's the way you play the game of business and real money. They don't have a problem with gathering all of it into their corner. And it doesn't bother them much to have everybody else economically crushed. I would suggest that I'm a social worker, and I see a lot of people who in real life have been economically crushed, and they don't feel a part of any of this. They long ago gave up on voting. They don't feel a part of the club of life, I guess. And I think that that's a real danger in our society, is to play this real game, real life game of Monopoly. We end up with a lot of crushed people, and crushed families stay crushed for generations and generations. Most never get out of that.
I think the Monopoly analogy is an interesting one. I never thought about saying it in that way, where yes, one person wins and everybody else loses. And it is interesting, because sometimes some of the people who are, some of the business folks that I mentioned, like three or four of Minnesota billionaires who are asking for public subsidies, we want free market, we want totally unregulated free market, except when we want something as, when it's to our benefit otherwise. But right after, the best way to explain the common good thing in my mind is after the Great Depression, which we pulled out of maybe partly, or a large part maybe, because of the war, we came back, we had just fought and won a war in two fronts against one, perhaps the worst threat to humanity in the last century. And we had nothing. I mean, we had rationing of everything. It was very poor economy. And what did we do? We not only invested in the GI Bill and housing and other things to get our economy moving, we also invested in Western Europe to help rebuild. We spent billions, billions in today's dollars in the Marshall Plan in doing that. Did Western Europe benefit from that? Did we benefit from it? I think in the long run, the common good thing can benefit people, and the economy does do better because of this. We have time for maybe two more.
About three questions. One, I'm from Colorado. Are you Democrat or Republican? That's the first one.
Okay, I'm a Democrat. In Minnesota, it's Democratic Farmer Labor Party. It was two parties that merged 50-some years ago. But
okay. And with the knowledge that you've been able to gain as a politician, did you get that through university or college, or is it just on the job training? And if there's term limits, you know, okay, we're losing a person that understands the system. How can we have a good series of politicians that understand the system, but maybe don't have a political agenda, but can help society?
Okay.
You're here as a Christian today, talking about this. How can Christians have a fair, equitable system?
Okay, how to solve every political problem we have? No, there's no answer to that in that sense, but I was going to say, as one who has not supported term limits, and interesting to watch, and I didn't support them when I first got elected, and I think my opponent did, it was just beginning of the term limits movement back then. I really believe term limits, that the politicians who talk about favoring term limits, there's some of them who I think are very sincere about it. There are very few of them. But like Eastern Washington, where they had the guy who ran on that issue, got elected in no more than 6 years, or I want you to vote against me, and then changed his mind when he found out how it could be more effective. I happen to think the best way to limit the terms of politicians is through elections. If you don't like somebody's direction, you may even disagree with them, but still think they got good judgment, or you trust their values, or whatever. I think that's what elections are for. And I also think that, like most businesses, you want some fresh blood in there from time to time. You also like some history. You like some people who understand. I wasn't there in the early 80s when Minnesota legislature was cutting and slashing and burning things and raising taxes because we hadn't prepared for the fact that the economy has ups and downs. And right now, in the last few years, we were estimating fairly conservatively. Now the state economists and others are suggesting we're not being quite as conservative. Right at the time when the economy, maybe it's been, the growth level has gone way down. Will the growth level start growing right away, or is it going to be a longer trough before it goes up again? I think it's helpful to have that long-term perspective. You're not going to find, quote, neutral people, nor do I know that you want, would I suggest you want neutral people who don't have any concerns. Certainly, I learned some things in college, I learned some things through life. We all, the longer you're living, presumably if you're experiencing new things, you learn something new every day. I like my job because I've been there 14 and a half years now, and every day I'm learning new things. And so I think there's benefit to that. I also don't think it would be healthy to have everybody stale. I think we definitely need to have more competitive election process, which goes back to a talk a couple of days ago about money and politics. I think we desperately need that. But I don't know how, there's no one thing you can do to make sure people are doing. I guess you have to try and find people you trust and whose judgment you value. I have a lot more respect for people who disagree with me politically, but who really believe in something, who I think have, are not blind ideologues in something because they heard this and they believe this and they know that something, but people who are thoughtful and trying to make wise choices and who might change their minds because of new information, not those who change their minds because of political pressure, but those who change their minds because they learned something new. And I hope that, I'm not sure how you elect people that do that. I'd say taking the money out would help a whole lot. But it's still going to be the fact that somebody, many people have said democracy is a terrible political system. Unfortunately, it's the best one we know how to do. So anyhow, I'm not sure that's a good answer to that. And I think that we're probably out of time. I'm happy to stay around and talk further if people have more questions. I hope this stimulates more thinking and maybe discussion over lunch and the rest of the day. So thank you for your attendance.